Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the Research Podcast Series, we are joined by Dr. Grant Dawson. Grant joined the School of International Studies as Assistant Professor in 2014. During 2019 to 2021, he was acting head of school. In 2007, Grant published the book, Here is Hell, Canada's Engagement in Somalia, and also published numerous other articles in Canadian and UK professional journals.
Prior to becoming a UNNC faculty member, Grant was Deputy Director of the David Davies Memorial Institute of International Studies, an integral part of the Department of International Politics at Aberystwyth University from 2009 to 2014. He was an International Relations and History Lecturer at Carleton University in Canada from 2006 to 2009, and at Aberystwyth University in the UK from 2011 to 12. He was also a visiting scholar at Xiamen University in 2012 and 2023, and in 2017 he was a visiting scholar at Fudan University in China.
In 2022, Grant published the journal article, No Future for Libya with Gaddafi, Classical Realism, Status and Revenge in the UK Intervention in Libya, in the Cambridge Review of International Affairs. And he is here to talk to us today about this research. Welcome, Grant.
Welcome, Grant.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Mary, what did you think of this article? I mean, this is way outside my wheelhouse. I know very little about Libya, not so much about the UK.
Sure. It's also outside of my area as well. But I am from the UK, and I was in the UK at the time that this was sort of all happening in 2011. If we talk about the British intervention in Libya. So this happened sort of around 2011, as Grant explained in the article and as he's going to talk more about. And I do, of course, remember this happening. I was aware of this at the time, so I was very much there. And I do remember being somewhat surprised about this intervention. And I do remember sort of understanding a little bit, or coming to understand a little bit, about the baggage, about the history between the UK and Libya at this time, which was something somewhat of a bit of a surprise to me. And I think reading Grant's article made so much more clear, made everything much more clear to me, and made me understand why sort of this happened. And of course, as Grant's going to tell us, this explanation is quite complex, and it doesn't fit completely within the framework we already have as such for understanding why countries will choose to have such an intervention in the politics and situation of another.
Media explanations as well.
It
was quite fascinating to me to read this, because even though it's not something I'm familiar with, it did become something really fascinating to me. So maybe we should let Grant tell us a bit more about the article.
I think it's about time we turned over
to
Grant.
Because he knows way more than we do. So please, Grant, good to have you here.
Thanks very much. That was actually very, very interesting. Now, part of me wishes you could continue and I could just continue to listen, because it was interesting. I remember a previous conversation was discussing, how can you say that leaders have emotions or perform emotions on behalf of their country? How is that credible? In particular, you know, the drive for status or maintaining status or even seeking to revenge on someone like Gaddafi. How could we imagine a leader would do that? A leader is simply a leader, an average person in the country. For example, Mary Jane in the UK at the time, as she's mentioned already, might not feel that. Why would a leader feel that? How could a leader feel that? And after that conversation with those people, I was thinking about it, and I realized that perhaps an analogy might be a way to clarify. For example, now, if we are people in New York City, we might not care so much. Some other governor, who cares, whatever. But the mayor of New York would feel, it would at least occur to him that he might need to defend the city against that attack. It's insulting. The city's reputation maybe had been disgraced. Maybe the city's reputation had been damaged. And it would at least occur to the leader of New York that they need to do something, that they need to address the concern for the city's pride and reputation in that way. It's not automatic because it's contingent. It would depend on the circumstances. Is the particular governor someone that New Yorkers care about? Is the particular governor got a good point? Does the particular governor have a national stage? All those sorts of things. The mayor of New York, is he the sort of guy who's got a thin skin? You know, if he's performing these sorts of roles on behalf of his community, he might feel especially sensitive. Like some prominent U.S. politicians today, I could imagine them reacting more strongly to a slight that they perceived to be slightly personal or impacting on their leadership role, right?
Grant, sorry to jump in here, because we've talked about this a little bit before, that there's a kind of metaphorical or synecdoche relationship between a leader and the institution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe the mayor of the city sees her or himself as representing the city, mm-hmm. the same way that in your article, you indicate that Cameron represents the state in certain places. Do you think that makes the kind of political personal because of that? Or what is the relationship?
I see it as being rooted in a type of human nature, I think. I think that humans, they want to be regarded as having a positive social identity. They want to be feeling as though they are admired or affirmed by others and so forth. And I think the smaller communities such as cities would feel this way. And I think countries feel this way too. These sorts of emotions and psychological drives, I think, are not confined to individual entities. So for example, an individual can feel this way about themselves, but also have these sorts of commitments with the state or with their city and so forth. And so too with leaders, they feel this certain way themselves. For example, if they were the head of New York City and New York City's reputation was being humiliated, they might personally feel also humiliated because they're in charge. Is leadership personal? I think one of the things that's an issue with IR scholarship, classical realism is the theory I work with especially, is there's a tendency to have the human drop out of the equation and just talk about the state doing something. But in fact, there's always an individual in charge. And so it's instructive to always keep in mind that there are, as a human there, and that these humans are acting rationally. But not only rationally, emotions and psychological drives are an integral part of their thinking process. Research has indicated that people who have had injuries and are not able to access their emotions anymore are unable to come up with responsible decisions. They are actually, it's not possible. The only type of entities that could reason without emotion would be like an android or something like that in science fiction.
Mm. I like your term there, that is actually a trick of language. Mm. You've almost sort of preempted one of my questions here, which was sort of building on Derek. I was quizzing the idea that kind of a person can be seen as representative of the actions of the state. But the way you phrase it is very interesting, because you actually talk about how can ultimately the state be representative of the actions of a person? Mm. Because this whole sort of paper and this whole situation is so much about the one specific actor, in this case, David Cameron.
And
how much this was motivated by his own personal emotion in that way. And I think you're absolutely correct in the way that this seems to have been left out of the equation very much. And it seems to be left out of almost IR as a field in the way that you talk about it. And I like that you reinsert this. You use the word revenge, which is such a kind of personal word, I think. You know, it's something that we associate, I think, with an individual action. I'm also a little bit conscious, though, that while we're talking about this, some of our listeners might not be entirely familiar with the situation.
Yes.
In Libya and with the UK's intervention there. So perhaps you could give us a a brief overview of this,
absolutely,
and how your paper actually analyzes that and responds to that.
Absolutely, I will. If I may just make one more remark before I provide that introduction. Indeed, David Cameron, the leader of the UK, had his personal worldview, his history, his own emotions and all that. But as I say, these reactions are contingent. They're not automatic. Performing the role of the emotional roles as the leader of a state can mean anything. So, for example, David Cameron had this personal reaction, a visceral dislike of Muammar Gaddafi always, who was the leader of Libya at the time. But, for example, had Gordon Brown still been Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Gordon Brown might have had a different personal history, a different worldview, a different feeling about Gaddafi. And it's quite possible he would have, because after all, the Brown government was known for the Blair government were known for making some deals with the Gaddafi government. The Brown government made...
I didn't know that, actually.
Oh, yes. The Brown government was in power when one of the Lockerbie bombers was released upon the decision of the Scottish government.
I remember this.
Jail.
There was uproar.
Yes,
it was
controversial. And he returned to Libya. He was released on compassionate grounds. It was thought that he was going to die from cancer soon. But he did not. The person lived for some more years. And Tony Blair, of course, his government was noted for another labor. Brown and Blair are both labor party governments, as we know. Cameron is conservative, so partisan differences here too. The Blair government was famous for negotiating the deal with the Gaddafi government, in which the Gaddafi government agreed to eliminate its WMD program in exchange for being de-isolated from international society, if you will. And so had Brown still been in power, Brown stepped down, was defeated by Cameron in 2010. And had Brown won that election, perhaps there would still be an emotional performance on behalf of Britain by its leader. But in this counterfactual, Prime Minister Brown in 2011 might have not called for intervention, for example, might not have had this drive to revenge Gaddafi. So that I just wanted to add that, but to provide some background, this case took place in 2011 as a result of the Arab Spring uprisings in the Middle East that started the year before. There was a dramatic act of resistance by a citizen of Tunisia in 2010 protesting his government. And this was the spark that led to widespread protests in various places around the region. After Tunisia, Egypt was next. And before too long, there were major protests and violence in Syria, Bahrain, Libya also, and perhaps other countries. This range of protests has been collectively called, as I've said already, the Arab Spring. And for a time, it looked like a flourishing of democratic and liberal protest and change. It hasn't worked out that way, but there were people who were within these countries and outside that were very optimistic for a time, calling, predicting these sorts of progressive political developments. And a particular crisis in Libya began in February of 2011 when armed protests began. Immediately, there was a political struggle between the supporters of action against Libya and others to characterize the violence. Some called it protests and an uprising. Others might call it a violent riot or something. Some people said that the Gaddafi government was mercilessly attacking and killing. Others said that his approach was just a ham-fisted, clumsy attempt at riot control, in which hundreds were killed. So very ham-fisted and clumsy. But this was not the state struggled, obviously. I don't want to stereotype any state, but the state obviously struggled to use peaceful methods. Perhaps it would have been impossible even for a very well equipped and organized and securitized state like the United States, perhaps even they would have struggled to keep violence at an acceptable minimum. But Libya struggled very much. Hundreds were killed, and reports were of even thousands were killed. The protesters appeared to become like revolutionaries and started to attack the state. They overwhelmed police stations, overwhelmed towns, and took leadership control of cities and moved west, I think, towards Tripoli, the capital of Libya. They stopped about halfway when the Libyan military started to mobilize and attack them. Of course, all these protesters, now revolutionaries, were not militarily experienced. And so the Libyan military, weak though it was able to knock them back. And it looked like Gaddafi regime was going to destroy this revolution and the potential for change. And in particular, call began to ring out a future counterfactual, if you will, that if Gaddafi retakes Benghazi, which was considered to be the capital of this protest now revolution, if he takes the city, he will cause a massive massacre that would inflict.
Who decided that was kind of a sort of tipping point, that was the moment?
Well, that's an interesting question. There was an escalation in the terminology used about the number of people being killed. Mm-hmm. So there was a narrative built up already that more and more people were being killed and that this was escalating towards something terrible. But in particular, it was countries such as the United Kingdom and France, especially at first, and then eventually the United States, that argued that we have to do something because if he gets to the people in Benghazi, he'll inflict this massive massacre. The credibility for those claims is based on the fact that public quotations of casualty figures already were so huge. But it was a type of representation, you know, a narrative about what was going on. Is it protest and revolution, or is it just a violent rebellion type mm-hmm. of thing? Is Gaddafi a murderous leader who ought to be under trial at the in The Hague? Or is he a leader who's struggling to protect his state and the other citizens from violence that is slipping out of control? There is a question of the narrative here, but the thing that was most powerful for the British, French, and Americans was this argument that if he gets to Benghazi, he'll cause a massacre. Mm-hmm. Because there seemed to be some credibility for this in the casualty figures, which were called credible, but never really confirmed, right? And of course, a counterfactual, future counterfactual, it can't be proven one way or the other. It was just a claim. But you could say, you know, this will stain the conscience of the world. Are you going to be responsible for doing nothing? Are you going to, how can you say that this won't happen? You know, mm-hmm. even now, you can't really claim that there wouldn't have been a massacre in Benghazi. And I don't
know. Is this the invocation of that responsibility to protect them?
Yes.
So the idea that these other nations bear a moral culpability if they don't protect the citizens being threatened there?
Yes, that's basically it. That was the heart of it. The Gaddafi regime was painted as a murderous, out-of-control regime, a criminal government. I think they even brought out comparisons of Gaddafi with European leaders in the 1930s and things like that.
That's an old trope.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Well, I'm hearing haunting echoes as well of the rhetoric around Saddam Hussein
absolutely,
and you know, this idea of he's gassing his own citizens. And then, I mean, granted, it was the previous labor government, the previous plus one labor government under Blair that came up with what's now called the dodgy dossier and all of that, weapons of mass destruction.
Yes.
But definitely the rhetoric around that time was you know, this is a murderous leader who is slaughtering his own people, and we have to step in.
And it became, there became more of a tone of urgency as it kind of went on and as it was sort of escalating to the point of the invasion of Iraq, I remember.
And a similar dynamic in a way in Libya, because as the Gaddafi military got closer and closer to Benghazi, the pressure ramped up and up on, in particular, the United States, because Britain and France were already on The intervention started in mid-March 2011. And by the start of March, both Britain and France were public about wanting to intervene. But the problem was is the United States wasn't in support. And I think the British and French both knew that they needed the United States' military support. The United States, even with Libya, a relatively weak military power and relatively close to Britain and France lacked certain logistical capabilities, electronic warfare capabilities, and ammunition supplies and things like that to sustain a conflict. And there is always the risk that it wouldn't be quick. And in fact, it wasn't quick. So they needed to have the Americans on board. And it took until Benghazi was about to fall when the Americans decided that they couldn't sit on the sidelines. They wanted the Europeans to provide as much leadership as possible. And in fact, that became a sticking point after the intervention because the Americans were a little bit disappointed with how quickly the Europeans were prepared to disengage from Libya. They thought they would take more of a leadership role and invest more in making sure Libya maintained stability and security.
From reading your paper as well, when you talk about this kind of push for this intervention, you mentioned the US and you mentioned France. Was Britain the driving force? I mean, was Cameron very much the driving force, though, within all of this?
I would say Britain was the key actor with France. The United States was not the key actor, although it became the key actor once it finally decided to engage in mid-March. Mm-hmm. France was very assertive about the idea of acting against Libya, I think for its own reasons. I haven't looked into those reasons in detail. The Cameron government, almost right away, was also strongly vested in acting tough against and firmly, decisively is the word I'm looking for, against the Libya regime.
What exactly was this intervention? Could you just outline it?
Yes, I'm sorry. I get distracted from my background information, don't I? So
we love background information.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah, me too. So Arab Spring, the protests, which immediately became violent, started in Libya in mid-February. The intervention in Libya, led by the United States, Britain, and France, began in mid-March. The arguments in favor of the intervention were, as I say, this fear that a huge massacre would be caused in Benghazi city of Libya if Gaddafi was allowed to conquer it. So the interveners, Britain, France, and the United States, made an argument based in part on this concept called responsibility to protect, which is a sort of a concept, a principle, if you will. It's not legal. It builds on certain legal commitments and things like that, but is not a legal obligation in any sort. R2P says that if a host state is unwilling or unable to prevent a mass atrocity within its borders, that then responsibility can fall, it's not automatic, can fall to the international community to do something about it. Now, the international community is supposed to initially offer diplomatic supports and help and things like that and pressure and things.
R2P is responsibility to protect.
Yes, indeed.
Right. Yeah, right.
Yes, indeed. It's called R2P. And this responsibility can lead to military action too, which obviously is the most controversial part of the whole concept.
I was just going to question, because some of the ways that this responsibility to protect is framed in the paper makes me wonder how much of it is using it as a rhetorical device. So you invoke the responsibility to protect if you already have other motives for intervention in a state. You seem to indicate at some point it's tied in using O'Sullivan's work with the history of colonial interventionism. And so, you know, how much of this is a kind of colonial mindset, or, you know, when is R2P invoked? Is it only when it's a state that you believe you're responsible for, not someone else? Is it an indicator of some form of exceptionalism? I'm just wondering about your perception of it.
Yes, indeed. That's a very good question. I think the colonial mentality about imposing civilization or virtues and values on less developed civilizations, and I put quotations around all of that, of course, is indeed part of the impulse here with respect to Libya. Of course, Libya was colonized by Italy, not by Britain and France, so they don't have that history. But they do have an imperial history of their own, as we know very well. And I think that that idea of superiority, of providing other peoples with the benefits, they want to live like us. They want our values and principles. We need to help them to get to where we are. That sort of superior attitude, indeed, the idea that, for example, British values and principles are synonymous with global values and principles of peoples, maybe not regimes, because some regimes officially are different, but the peoples there, they aspire to what we have. That idea was definitely animating British thinking, for example.
That really interested me. And it surprised me by how much of that thinking is still so relevant in British life. This idea of kind of, you talk about the great power status in the article, this idea of preserving the supposed position of the UK as a great power. And I do remember as a child being taught this narrative. I do remember this narrative in schools of this idea that the UK had run the world and everything had been great then, and this had been a huge empire, and this being very much constructed as a positive thing. And obviously, getting older, I have come to reflect on that and question that much more. But reading the paper, it amazed me by how much that is still extremely relevant and cogent, particularly for people who are in power and come from the political ruling class, such as David Cameron.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I can address that in just a moment. I just wanted to finish by saying that in addition to that mentality about, I think British leaders thought their values, their leadership were needed by others around the world. R2P, it's also been noted, the interventions that have taken place usually have been into places that are militarily weak, where the Western militaries are able to overwhelm the countries very fast. Libya's air defenses were destroyed in 4 hours or something like that. And after that, the NATO powers. NATO was the British-French-American instrument for the intervention. They didn't intervene by themselves with their own militaries, but through NATO. And reports were that, you know, you'd be walking around cities in Gaddafi-held Libya, and buildings would just blow up, like with no warning, because they didn't even have air raid sirens in some places. And so the air superiority was, well, they had command of Libya's airspace, is the military term, and could do whatever they wanted. The control was so great that, you know, there was one famous report. This was mentioned at the time as an example of how compassionate and sensitive Western powers are. There's a Libyan soccer football game going on, and the NATO airplanes waited until the soccer game was over and then bombed the target. Like, they had so much power that they could just hang on and wait and maybe see what the final score was. No, sorry, I shouldn't make a joke like that. They had complete superiority over Libya, and so too in other cases where Western powers have intervened, not always with R2P though. For example, but superiority in the Iraq case and superiority in the Serbia case and the Balkans and things like that. Superiority in the Somalia case. Most of these all these cases are pre-R2P, of course, but the Libya case was considered to be a real high point for R2P initially. It became much more skepticism developed, as I report in the article, because after the intervention began, the Libya regime didn't collapse. It modified its tactics and continued to fight. And And so the NATO-led intervention had to deploy more and more violence and more strikes and so forth against the Gaddafi regime and its command and control infrastructure and military forces on the ground. And it became apparent that the goal was not to stabilize the conflict or to prevent a massacre in Benghazi, which was achieved quickly, but to defeat the Gaddafi regime, to overthrow it, really. As I say, no future for Libya with Gaddafi, which is a quotation from an op-ed that Barack Obama, David Cameron, and French President Nicolas Sarkozy published in the New York Times. So that was the objective, I think, for Britain from the beginning, and probably for France too. I'm not so sure for the United States. I think they just felt they could not get involved at some point. And this awareness that the RTP had become instrumentalized by the interveners. So it wasn't simply about preventing mass atrocities, but it had political intent as well. It has, I think, colored treatments of RTP and assessments of its viability in the future. So the intervention lasted from mid-March to end October 2011. And by around mid-late August 2011, the Gaddafi regime was visibly collapsing. And it took a little bit more time before it was all over, and Gaddafi was horribly assassinated at the end. So this was the intervention. A massacre was prevented, but arguably the intervention, it could be said, extended and prolonged the violence and resulted in a lot more deaths through fighting, but that's a type of claim that doesn't really...
That's a difficult one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't tell, hypotheticals, right? Yeah. Is this the reason, Grant, why you discuss Catherine Gugu's theory of, you know, placing the four motivations for military intervention? And according to the article, security is the highest, then status, then economic gain, and then humanitarianism is ranked the lowest. And you don't challenge that either. You challenge the notion of status versus security, but not the lowest ones.
That's right. Humanitarianism always the lowest?
Well, according to Jugot's research of European intervention, yes, it is. That's not to say that humanitarianism doesn't matter. And Derek, we were talking about how R2P could be a rhetorical thing. But in fact, there's a narrative that's hidden about superiority and about power advantages and things like that. While that's true, that's not to say that the Western governments, France, Britain, and the United States, didn't believe in humanitarianism. The humanitarian concern that they were expressing wasn't faked. They did have these sincere concerns. They were sincerely disturbed by the reports they were hearing. They didn't fake it. There is research about foreign policy decision making that suggests that leaders can't like make all this stuff up, because in fact, if you pretend that you care about something, how could you make decisions based on something that you're faking, right? It wouldn't work out after a while.
Is it also a kind of you fake it till you make it? So you actually start believing what you're faking after a while?
Well, I don't know. That's about kind of commercial success, fake it until you make it. And like, what would making it mean in this case? Like,
your academic success.
Yeah.
I suppose that making it would mean actually invading the nation or getting what you want from the nation, so that in the end you actually believe your own nonsense, your own rhetoric, in a sense. Because you sort of did actually see that, I almost feel, after the Iraq war, in that you did see a sort of genuine astonishment from a lot of people that this didn't create the paradise they've been promising.
Yeah.
So you sort of felt after a time like, well, did you actually believe what you were saying?
And where were the WMD in Iraq? Do you remember the Secretary of State for the United States?
Rumsfeld.
I think
north, south, east, and west somewhere, I think he said, right?
Yeah.
There are known unknowns.
I remember
that speech.
but Colin Powell had a famous speech. He was the Secretary of State before Rumsfeld, I think. And he had a famous speech in the UN Security Council where he was making the case for intervention in Iraq. And he had full color diagrams of chemical weapon bans that the Iraqis apparently had. And none of these things, it would appear, existed. And so you could say they faked that until they made that, but I'm not sure. That's an interesting case.
Sure,
perhaps it's a, I would have to think about that one a little bit more. But in this particular case, I do think that the humanitarian concerns were not rhetorical. Like the British and the French and the Americans were concerned about this. Their policymakers didn't know that the reports were false or not. And, you know, when you're immersed in this dynamic, you don't really have time to, you're not free emotionally or psychologically from the pressures and the dramas. And, you know, as I say, do you decide that this is all fake and take the risk that there won't be a huge slaughter, or do you, or must you take it on board? And some of the people who were interviewed afterwards said, you know, you could ignore it all, but that would have taken an enormous force of will to do so. You really, it's difficult to ignore a context you're in. You get immersed in the situation and it becomes a real for you. Even if there are certainly people being killed in Libya, was it going to be a massacre? That's highly debatable in my opinion. The people who were involved in the decisions didn't know for sure. And and I think they did feel that they did know for sure that they didn't want a massacre. Mm. And so they were, I think, operating on that basis.
It certainly feels like David Cameron believed that very, very much and very forcefully so. I was also going to talk about, you refer to in the article the classical realist theory. And you talk about how you want to kind of refine this to cover, kind of engage with the notion of intervention. Could you talk a little bit about that theoretical framework that you use and how you are adapting it?
Yes, indeed. Classical realism is a theoretical approach that was is most famously identified with a scholar called Hans J. Morgenthau. There are many classical realists, and they believe most of them slightly different things. So it's not a cohesive school all on the same page. Morgenthau and other classical realists, though, generally believe in a human nature-centered explanation for foreign policy and state behavior. They think that certain drives within human nature can explain foreign policy. This is a big distinction from the dominant school in realism today, which is called neorealism, or also structural realism, which emphasizes a precisely defined international state system structure as explaining how and why states act. Neorealism is much more emphasizing rationalism and states seeking to maximize power and guarantee security in an international environment of anarchy. Classical realism emphasized human nature and is talking about how, in particular, humans and human-constituted communities, including states, are energized, exercised by the drive for power. They seek power as a way to influence, to emphasize their perception of their own positive social identity, to have influence over the meanings and values of symbolic objects around the world, to convince others that their perceptions ought to be considered as legitimate. In other words, classical realism emphasizes that entities struggle for power in order to gain psychological domination over the minds of others. So this type of power that we're talking about is about influencing other people's minds and perceptions. And it's not necessarily about military power or how many nuclear missiles you have and all that sort of thing. Though that's an instrument, all right. Because obviously, if I have more nuclear missiles and a much stronger military, and we're having a social conflict over the interpretation of a treaty, the fact that I have superior military power might help me gain that psychological influence that I seek to get you to see my perspective, that sort of thing. So the classical realism emphasizes the struggle for power. It says that all humans wish it and need it. And it's based on philosophical ideas about, without getting into too much detail, about the existence of humans, the meaning of existence. When people come into being and become aware of themselves, the argument goes that they feel insufficient, they're incomplete, they need to find some sort of sense of wholeness, and they achieve this through assertions of power to fill that void by drawing onto themselves affirmations of approval, by imposing their sense of meanings and values and on others and other things. They can temporarily at least close this void. That's the sort of idea. That's why the human entities want to struggle for power and feel compelled to do so. in most cases, and including human constituted communities like states. Classical realism says that state entities are struggling for power for this reason in the international arena. And neorealism really believes that we can see lots of patterns and regularities in international politics. We can have Cold War I, and we're having Cold War II now, for example. Classical realism emphasizes contingency and history and social context. So obviously human nature, when we talk about a drive for power, lust for power, if you will, that's a very general pattern, isn't it? It's not very specific. So how exactly entities will struggle for power will depend on the particular actors in charge, the leaders in charge, the context of the time. And nothing is guaranteed. It's, while we can say that leaders will struggle for power, what exactly that will mean in a given situation in a given time period depends on various factors. So contingency is key.
I was fascinated by this as well, because the idea that perhaps the systems are set up so that those who most seek power are those who least should wield it by the time they get it.
Yes.
Because the way it's framed, I mean, it's Morgenthau that invokes Augustine of Hippo, right? Who says that basically you can't achieve moral perfection in a state because the people who are going to be controlling the state have to be morally corrupt to get to the position which they can then control it. Is that a fair summary of the point
It's a fair summary. There's a tendency, research has indicated, that the people who aspire to high political positions tend to be risk acceptant and egotistical and things like that. And there's a big debate in classical realism, IR scholarship in general, is the place of morality in foreign policy and in international politics. And classical realism is often accused of being amoral and illegal and everything, like raw lust for power and all that. But that's a bit of a caricature, in my opinion. Leaders of states, their foreign policy is always going to be moral, corresponding to the morality of their national community. They're expressing this, they're demonstrating that. What Morgenthau always argued against was the tendency for states to project their morality in an attempt to make it universal around the world. He said that is not going to work. You can't impose your morality around the world. And so when aspiring to gain this psychological influence, you may find that moral precepts cannot drive foreign policy, but they aren't absent from it either, because they are underlying basically what you're trying to do and what you're trying to achieve, your framework for the world. But there are frequent problems with this. As Augustine of Hippo, I think, was addressing, the lust for power can be quite reasonable in the sense of a state aspiring for this influence, this power to exercise control over how things will be defined and evaluated, to impress others with its value system, its positive social identity. You need power in order to emphasize that what you are is worthy of being emulated and so forth. But so there's a reasonable element to it, but there's also, it's, since it's human, it can be extreme, it can be limitless, it can go beyond what's reasonable, egotistical satisfaction, a lust that is limited, unlimited, and out of control. Some leaders who have no restraints on themselves domestically, for example, Adolf Hitler in the 1930s in Germany, this can lead to extremist militaristic adventure.
Grant, listening to you talk about this, you have clearly invested quite a lot of yourself in this subject. I'm very interested in why, out of all these fascinating sort of scenarios, you got very interested in the UK and the Libya intervention here. Because I'm looking at your sort of background, and while obviously the theoretical knowledge and the field knowledge is there, you're not from the UK, and you're previous book-length publication was addressing Canada and Somalia. So this seems to be a bit of a change So could you tell us how exactly you got interested in this and how this paper actually came about?
Yes, indeed. That is an interesting story. I might have mentioned at the beginning that this is the only thing I've written that is not about Canada. And the reason for that is I was at Aberystwyth University in the UK when this project started, the first ideas of it. And I was talking with a senior colleague who I was working with, Professor Ken Booth, who's a major IR theorist, really nice guy too. And he suggested I do a paper on the Libya intervention, which was happening, and the UK role in it. Part of the reason was is when you're outside of Canada, the excitement studying Canada outside of Canada is a harder sell, because not everyone is convinced that Canada has a broader explanatory appeal, if you will. And so he was saying, maybe don't study Canada, maybe study the UK as well, instead, because the UK is still a great power. This is something that more people would want to read. Looking at topics other than Canada might help to increase my readership and so forth. The other thing that's interesting about that paper is the way it unfolded. It's my most social scientific paper, where I talk about causal analysis, and it's more positivist in the sense of imagining that empirical reality is really there and it's waiting for us to categorize it and evaluate it and describe it. It's my most social scientific sort of paper, and I think that sort of developed as a result of the editorial process and so forth. I was pushed to toughen the causal analysis approach and to strengthen the process tracing method and so forth.
Did they push you specifically towards looking at the UK-Libya relationship? Because I'm somewhat surprised there hasn't been perhaps more written on this actual kind of one case study, or maybe there is.
No, they didn't push me to focus on Libya and the UK.
So how did that come about?
Oh, well, it was because the intervention, I was aware of the intervention, and my colleague at Aberystwyth was a British person. You sort of have to try harder to justify it. You see, like when I do my research in Canada now, I have a multi-chapter project that will be in my next book about classical realism and cases of Canadian politics and foreign policy, but you really have to emphasize the theory. It's IR, so you have to intensify theory in generally anyway, but the theoretical contribution becomes very important, because people won't necessarily be convinced that the Canada case study is interesting enough unless you can somehow provide the inference that it's got broader applicability, or that the theory you're using can be generalized to other cases and things like that. So I was in the UK, and I wasn't sure when, if ever, I'd get back to Canada. And my senior colleague was saying to me, okay, you're interested in intervention, you're interested in classical realism, but maybe you shouldn't talk about Canada since it's not a huge player in this intervention anyway. Talk about the UK. They're a prominent actor in this intervention. And so it was his initial encouragement that turned me to the UK case, because I hadn't really studied UK politics and foreign policy before then in detail.
I like the fact that you're sort of coming to that with very fresh eyes. And that sort of, it does make me feel like ultimately maybe you were actually able to see this element, this kind of extra element of revenge and the great power status in perhaps a way that an academic who's more mired in this field may not. Why did you choose this journal as well, the Cambridge Review of International Affairs?
Some colleagues here at in the School of International Studies here at University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, encouraged me to approach the journal. They said it was a good journal, fairly quick. Some journals in the IR discipline are so slow. I'm currently in the review process with a journal, and it's been over a year, and it's still going on. But Cambridge Review of International Affairs was faster and has a good reputation. And so I was advised to go there to try them.
I'm interested in the reviewer sponsors here, because I could sort of see how this paper could be quite polarizing in some ways.
Yeah. Well, indeed. I confess that it was a few years ago, and I don't recall in detail what the review responses were. At first, I was overclaiming, they said. I was saying that this explanation is why the intervention happened. And the reviewers were saying, well, it certainly was relevant, but I don't think it explains everything that was going on. You haven't convinced us of this. And as I say in the abstract there, not causally conclusive, but important, necessary, but not.
So you did respond to that?
Yeah, I did. I had to back away from the claims, become more moderate in my claims, and I had to make those adjustments.
Even still, Grant, was there any reaction to the article from once it was published? So did you have any feedback from that?
Well, I was thinking...
What intervention did it
in your field? Zing. It's been cited a fair number of times. I regret that I haven't looked at the site count lately, but it's got tons of downloads.
How can you not look at your site count?
Every morning.
I've got it bookmarked. Yeah. Come on, guys.
Yeah, a little app on your desktop. It's always there.
So too much.
Yeah. I haven't looked to read it lately, but it's had thousands of downloads. I haven't come across opposition or criticism of it. I think it's been a good contribution to the debate. But obviously, people who are R2P scholars, it's not what they want to read. And I think some people who are British foreign policy scholars, it might not be what they want to read either. Perhaps this is a good time to touch on the status and revenge aspect, which I haven't really addressed so much. Like, as I say, classical realism emphasizes this lust for power aspect and so forth, and how states want to gain psychological influence over others. Part of the way, so the idea of prestige or status is something that Morgenthau talked about a lot, but he saw status as kind of an instrumental thing. Like if you have status, then your promises or your threats become more credible. That's sort of how he saw status. He called it prestige. That's why I keep on mixing the terms. But the more theoretical term these days is status, because it emphasizes rank in a hierarchy, status. But status can also be conceived of being an instrumental thing. That is to say, something that the human entities, the humans enjoy personally and value, that matters to them, that they're high ranking and important and so forth. And I think that I see this very much as being something that is influencing Cameron and his foreign policy approaches, and was a key thing that was going on. And I think the government in the literature, status is also linked at times to revenge. And the reason for that is if you feel that your status has been infringed upon by an actor, you may wish to seek revenge on them. And in particular, these feelings can be harsh. There could be a diplomacy of anger that's reinforced by the belief, the memory that the actor that's wronged you is inferior to you. If you believe that they are inferior, like a ragtag bunch of people who organized an attack on New York City and Washington and September 2011, you know, how could these people do that? You know, the fury is even greater. And in this particular case, the Cameron government, its leadership had a visceral dislike of Gaddafi because of killing of a London policewoman, of allegations that the Gaddafi regime had supported the IRA, and because of allegations that the Gaddafi regime was behind the Lockerbie bombing, as well as other attacks in other Western targets. And so there is this is the opportunity to do something about this finally. The Labour governments of Brown and Blair had put material benefits and trade things in front of honor and status and restoring our dignity. We will never let that happen again, Cameron said.
You make such a convincing argument, Grant. I can very much imagine how the reviewers might have asked you to tone that down slightly.
Still did get the term hatred, right? So you stated that Cameron had a hatred for Gaddafi.
Yeah.
Which to me seems quite extreme, but you know, you can justify that, can you?
Yeah. Well, it's a dramatic word, but I think that it can be understood as the product of a lot of reflection on the part of Cameron and his belief that the United Kingdom is a great power and that these sorts of things ought not to happen to a great power, especially because of a weak country. And then to see Cameron Gaddafi to continue in office decade after decade and to be rewarded for taking apart his WMD with legitimization, mm-hmm. and by also receiving back the citizen that was apparently responsible for Lockerbie, these sorts of things made the wound fresh as far as Cameron was concerned.
Yeah. On that note, what do you hope to achieve from this paper? I mean, what conversation do you hope has been started?
Well, a few. First of all, I hope that one of my larger projects that is spilling into my Canada book now is the idea that classical realism is a very malleable and rich framework, which more modern theories can be plugged into. I think that there's lots of aspects of classical realism, such as status theory, such as emotions, that aren't really so developed in classical realism. But we have much more theoretical work now that enables us to develop these aspects of classical realism much more fully than Morgenthau ever did. And so I'm hoping to make theoretical contributions to classical realism in a variety of ways. Status theory and emotions in this particular case. I'm also working with critical approaches, critical theory and post-structuralist approaches in Hans J. Morgenthau's classical realism. And I'm having a mental block, but the paper I have under review is also using a different theory, and I can't even remember it.
when it's under review, review, you're supposed to forget about
and,
it.
And in addition, a contribution to R2P, because I think there's a lot of liberal scholars in the IR sphere who champion R2P as an example of liberal values and how liberal values and principles and perceptions, if they aren't universalized already, should be, and they see these liberal values and principles that are embedded in part in R2P as inherently good, and we should seek to encourage state leaders around the world to think in these terms. I want to criticize that and to suggest that this is just another instrument for the powerful to justify, as I say in one of my early paragraphs, to justify violent aggrandizement, there we go, that otherwise might have been looked at as a type of military aggression. Mm-hmm. And so to call attention to the fact that liberal countries have this lust for power also, they may disguise it differently, may disguise it better, but it's also there. It is something that's a characteristic of humans.
So when's the book coming?
Well, it'll be a few years. Unfortunately, this particular paper probably can't be a part of it because it's about the United Kingdom. I wish I thought about that earlier on. But I'm going to do a project about Hans J. Morgenthau's classical realism and cases of Canadian politics and foreign policy. One chapter has been published already. This is on Canada and the Saudi Arabia dispute that started in 2018. The current paper that's under review is about Canadian provincial international relations and how that can be explained using a classical realism emotions and practice theory approach. And the current paper that I'm researching now is Canadian foreign policy. I'm not sure if it's going to be about development assistance or the Ukraine war. Social imaginaries, which is image that peoples can have of who they are, and critical approaches to theory. So the other chapters, I'll tell you later.
Well, thank you very, very much, Grant, for coming in to talk to us today.
Thank you, Grant.
Fascinating to hear about all of this.
It's my pleasure. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for listening, and it's great to talk to you.
Well, we look forward to reading the book.
And we wish you all the best for the future. Thank you, Grant.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.